Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two cases on our docket this afternoon for oral argument. We will hear the first case, and then we will take a brief recess for a panel change, and we will hear the second case. So I understand that counsel have announced the time they would like to argue and told our clerk that time, correct? Okay, so we are ready to proceed if our clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call University of North Texas Health Science Center.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. The University of Texas Health Science Center believed that the trial court erred in denying its motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. The university was entitled to receive notice of this claim within 6 months of it occurring. The appellees have conceded that they did not give us formal written notice under subsection A. So the question before the court is whether or not the notations in the medical records show you or demonstrate to you that the university had actual knowledge of this claim. And we believe it does not. This is a medical malpractice case. And just very quickly, I'm going to go over some of the medical facts in this case. The records show that Mrs. Knight developed esophageal spasms. These were very extreme and needed to be corrected. She goes to the University of North Texas, and she's seen by Dr. Uverti. Dr. Uverti decides that she needs to have a surgery, and the surgery was performed on December the 11th, 2013. The surgery went well. There were no complications on December the 11th, immediately after the surgery. The next day, she had an esophagram. And basically, for the court's awareness, esophagram is when you're giving the patient some barium, they swallow the barium, and then a radiologist looks at the esophagus and determine whether or not there's any issues that can be identified.
Yeah, Counselor, is there anything in the record that suggests whether, I mean, let's just assume for the sake of argument that there was a perforation of her esophagus during that December the 11th surgery? Is there anything in the record that would show one way or another whether something like that might take more than 24 hours to manifest itself?
No, Your Honor, there's nothing in the records. What we have in the records that's presented to the court today is that the esophagram was determined and the whole was performed. And the whole purpose of the esophagram is to determine whether or not there are any leaks or any deficiencies that needs to be addressed. There were none. She goes 7 days. And she's still having some minor complications as a result of this very complex surgery. The doctors at UNT decided to do a second esophagram, and it was during that time that they identified a linear tear. And then they go in and they repair it. They believe that linear tear was a result of blood loss not properly getting to that area, and secondary to a perforation.
Yeah. Talk to us a little about the difference between, I mean, I understand that they would both result in your esophagus leaking or whatever the bad thing that happens, but what's the difference between a tear and a perforation? Do they have different causes?
I don't think that they have different causes. I think that is just the medical terminology that was used in these two cases. Perforation, in my opinion, and I believe the opinion of Dr. Uverti and the doctors, would mean that someone took a knife or a scalpel and actually made that incision. And I don't think that there was any evidence that occurred in this case, Your Honor.
I guess I'm just trying to make sure that the terminology is something that I understand, because I noticed that in the affidavit that the doctor provided, he said he located a linear tear.
Yes, Your Honor.
But then there's a December 21st medical record at 225 of the clerk's record where he says there appeared to be evidence of a linear 5-centimeter perforation. So I just didn't know if those two are used interchangeably or if there's really a difference?
I think they're used interchangeably. And if you look at the page 224 of the court records, he also says, once we cleared away and were able to identify the esophagus, there appeared to be a 5-centimeter linear tear in the esophagus. This appears to be a secondary to ischemia and then a perforation. So I do believe that in this terminology, he was using it in slightly different contexts here.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay. I think that both Appellees and myself have identified basically what the issues are in this case. You either believe that the notations in the medical records alone put the university on notice of actual notice of this incident, or you don't. In evaluating this case, we both brought up two very important cases. It's the McQueen case in this case. The Teresa McQueen versus University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston case, or you believe in the University of Texas Southwestern case versus Aaron Sebia. In the McQueen case, the courts, which is very similar to the case we have here today, what happened was Teresa McQueen goes in, she has a hysterectomy, they identify a bowel perforation. They put it in the notes, and the doctor also identified that the treating physician was the same doctor who identified this perforation. Plaintiff comes back and saying, I understand we didn't give you formal written notice, same as we have in this case. However, because it's in the medical records that a perforation was identified, and we know who performed this surgery, therefore, we have actual knowledge in this case. The Court of Appeals in Houston came back and said that cannot be the case. This is a medical malpractice case. There are instances where bad results happen, and the mere fact that you have an incident in a hospital cannot put the university on notice that something occurred in this case. The court McQueen said, and looking at the medical notation in this case, there was nothing in that notation that showed to the court or demonstrated to the court what caused that perforation, nor that the doctor believed that he did or did not do something to cause that tear. I believe you have that in this case here. The plaintiff, in presenting his best evidence to you, he in fact asked you to look at page 24, the notation on 24. And in looking at that notation, I think that we have the same factual scenario as we had in McQueen. There's nothing in that particular notation that shows you that Dr. Uverti did anything to cause this incident or that he had a subjective belief that he contributed to this incident in any way. It was merely that it was identified in the treatment of Ms. Knight, and it was resolved. I think that unless he can show the elements of A, which is injury, the time and place, and the person, along with the subjective awareness that's required in C, I don't think that you've met the standard to show that the university had actual knowledge in this case. The plaintiff, in this case, like to compare this to the Aaron Sebia case. And as the court know, in Aaron Sebia, there were a lot of factors that were present in Aaron Sebia that are not present here. The only thing that we're dealing with in this case is the notation in the medical records. In Aaron Sebia, what happened in that case is they had a whole bunch of complications too. The plaintiff goes in, she has a hernia surgery. There's numerous complications as a result of this hernia surgery. The treating physician goes and tells his supervisor, hey, I believe there was a mistake in treating Ms. Aaron Sebia. The supervisor goes and tells the risk manager, hey, I believe there was a mistake in treating Ms. Aaron Sebia. The supervisor and the treating doctor also make a note in their assessment that they believe that they were somehow at fault. I think the case in Aaron Sebia, correctly the court said, all the elements of A plus that additional element of C, subjective awareness, is there in Aaron Sebia. But I don't think that you have it here.
Let me ask you a hypothetical. Let's say that you have an employee of somebody like your client, and for whatever reason, you know, that they might think I did something wrong, but they don't tell anybody and they don't put it in the medical records, you know, because they, for whatever reason, would that situation be sufficient if the doctor is aware that something went wrong but didn't put it in the medical records? Is that actual notice to the doctor's employer?
I would say that that would be stretching the limits of what I believe would be notice or kind of imputed notice to the university. I think that unless the doctor articulate his belief that he did something wrong, I think the university would just be speculating or surmising that something occurred in this case. I don't think that we have this in this factual situation. At all. I don't think that Dr. Uverti made any determination within the time period prescribed by law that he did or didn't do anything in this case, nor did he tell his supervisor or risk manager in this case.
Well, they gave us another reference to the medical records that basically says for the 1220 procedure, preoperative diagnosis, distal esophageal perforation. 2, status post-esophageal myotomy?
Myotomy. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then procedures performed. Left thoracotomy with repair of esophageal perforation. If you take those three things in logical order, doesn't it sound like there was a perforation and the original esophageal myotomy that was repaired in the second procedure?
I think that if you're looking at that medical notation in isolation, I do think that it shows you that there was a perforation and a repair. I think that in order for you to meet the elements or the requirements of 101C, you not only have to show the time and place and that an injury occurred, which that might demonstrate to the court. I think that you have to show, and I think the court is very consistent about this, that you have to show some type of subjective awareness that you believe that you caused or contributed to this incident. Nothing in this notation that you find in December 20, 2012 gives you that those elements. Nothing in that shows you other than the fact that a perforation was identified and it was repaired.
Doesn't it create a fact issue?
I don't believe it creates a fact issue. I think that you need a little bit more than the fact that this occurred to create a fact issue. I think the courts are very consistent. The mere summation, a supposition of a fact does not rise to the level of a fact issue. I think you need more than that mere scintilla of evidence that this notation presents to you to show that there's a fact issue in this case, and I don't believe that it does show you that.
But in a plea to the jurisdiction, aren't we supposed to view all the facts in the light most favorable, the pleaded facts in the light most favorable to the non-movement or to the party asserting jurisdiction?
Absolutely, Your Honor, but they still have to present to you the requisite level of evidence to prove to you that this government has waived its immunity in this case. And I don't believe that's the case that we have here today. I don't think that you can surmise or add supposition on how this occurred. I think that the plaintiff or the medical records...
What about inferences? Don't we have to view all inferences? Isn't it the same as a summary judgment standard? Isn't that what the Supreme Court said in Miranda?
I don't believe the court said in Miranda that you have to review all inferences in light of the plaintiff. But I think that if you're asking whether or not circumstantial evidence can meet the burden in this case, which I believe the court is asking, I would take the position that it does not. I think that in evaluating circumstantial evidence, it has to be that the series of facts that the court is analyzing, after that analysis, the court can reach no other conclusion that the facts are true. And in this case, I don't believe that that is the case. I think that just because she suffered a perforation, just because we have a physician, a UNT, performing the surgery, I don't think that you can automatically jump to the assumption that UNT was responsible or UNT is somehow was at fault in creating this perforation. This was a very complex surgery. Immediately after this surgery, there was no perforations identified. So I would say that this case is closer to the Stevens case where there was a delay in identifying, and the court comes back and say that you don't have actual notice. There was a delay. There was a 7-day delay in identifying this perforation. I don't think that the appellees, I don't think myself, I don't think the court can really identify what occurred in that 7 days or can definitively say that the surgery that occurred on December the 11th by Dr. Uverte caused that perforation. If the court cannot make that determination, I don't think, excuse me, they met the burden in this case. The record, I think, is clear.
Expired. We'll hear from you on rebuttal. Thank you.
Sorry.
No problem.
May it please the court.
Maxwell.
Thank you for the opportunity of presenting this today. Ms. Cobb and I were talking when we first got here today. This is a little unusual because it's a remarkably simple fact situation. I mean, what Ms. Cobb says is absolutely right. We know what the statute says about written notice, and written notice was not given within 6 months, but the statute provides for circumstances where there may have been actual notice, and of course that's what our argument is. When you think about it, there's a very good reason for the part of the statute that allows for actual knowledge to constitute legal notice. I mean, it's a tough burden. I think it's fair to say that a large number of potential plaintiffs would be completely unaware that they have only 6 months to give that notice to a governmental entity. And in fact, I can cite a number of cases where a client may not have come in to me within that 6-month period. So the statute allows for actual knowledge, and it sets out very clearly what the elements of actual notice are. The government unit has knowledge of an injury, that it was the governmental entity or its agent that was at fault in producing the injury, and then it gives the identity of the parties involved. Now, as Ms. Cobb and I have talked about, in this case, this really comes down to one thing and one thing only. Either what's in those records constitutes the knowledge of UNT Health Science Center that something had happened that could establish fault on their part for an injury that was sustained by Ms. Knight, or it's not there in the records. Now, it's really important, and what's helpful to our position in this case is what we point out in our brief. Circumstantial evidence can be used to show subjective awareness of an event. So when we look at the records, and I'm picking up on what Justice Kerr asked about a minute ago, the records show the kind of procedure that was performed on December the 11th of 2012. The records also show the beginning, virtually immediately, Ms. Knight began to deteriorate. Problems developed. Other testing was performed such that 8 days later after the procedure was performed, Dr. Uverte was back in there doing another procedure, and that procedure very specifically notes that there was a perforation. Now, this is really important because there is absolutely no suggestion that the perforation or the linear tear, as it may be referred to, occurred from any other source other than the surgery that was performed on December the 11th of 2012. Dr. Uverte knew that something bad had happened because he went in to try to repair what had happened, and he did 3 more procedures in the week following that. I think it's very important to distinguish the concept of fault from liability. This is not an exercise in us taking the position today, Dr. Uverte was negligent in what happened. That's an argument we're going to make on another day. This is simply our position that Dr. Yervati, by what is in those records, knew very well. He had perforated this lady's esophagus in the surgery he performed, and that was causing major problems. And there's no question that the perforation is there and that he knew about it. Now, UNTHSC takes two different attacks on this. First of all, that the records themselves don't, just because something shows up in the records, it does not necessarily mean that constitutes proper notice. But the case that they cite, and in fact the case that Ms. Cobb recited to you a minute ago, the McQueen case, doesn't say that. In fact, what the McQueen case suggests is that the records themselves can constitute proper notice unless there's a suggestion that there may have been another entity or another reason that bears responsibility for the injury. That's not present in this case. There's no suggestion that anything other than the surgery of December 11th by Dr. Yervati caused this perforation. Nothing. And I don't think that Ms. Cobb disputes that. The second approach they take is the Davis case approach, where they say that, well, you given notice the way, or the records constituting notice, as you're alleging, don't give notice to the proper entity, because that doesn't necessarily mean that Dr. Yervati, by being aware that he had perforated this lady's esophagus, that doesn't impart any duty to him to tell UNTHSC, there's something bad that's happened, we need to be prepared for this. But that's not what the cases say. And in fact, I've discussed it in my brief at length, that notice to a doctor that is contained in the records, first of all, is proper notice. Secondly, the Davis case is very distinguishable, because in that case, and I think the question was asked a little bit earlier, in that case, a bus driver was put on notice of an incident that involved a DART bus, and the holding there was that, well, notice to the bus driver is not going to be noticed to the city of Dallas under those circumstances. Very distinguishable from a case like this, where there is a record, Dr. Yervati's record, noting there was a perforation which resulted in injury and which ultimately resulted in Ms. Knight's death. I submit that there is more than sufficient evidence to uphold the finding of the trial court and to deny the plea to the jurisdiction. Thank you.
Cobb, rebuttal?
The appellees want the court to believe that just because they were able to show an injury, that somehow the university had actual knowledge of the case. I think the court should look at the Texas Department of Criminal Justice versus Simon case. In that case, we have pretty much the scenario that appellees have asked you to evaluate. In that case, there was no question that the prisoner at that time suffered an injury. There was an investigation. And the investigation revealed that the criminal justice system played some role in that incident. And the question was whether or not a determination was made that they somehow knew that they were at fault. They interviewed the prisoner. Mr. Simon told them that he believed that he was at fault. The court came back and said that unless you can show that somehow within that 6 months that the government knows that they, of their fault in contributing to this incident, whether or not you know of the incident, whether or not you investigated the incident, you have to have subjective awareness of your fault. We don't have this in this case. Now, I ask the court to be ever so mindful that this is a medical malpractice case. There are complications, numerous complications, that every hospital has to deal with. If every time you identify a potential injury or something, a risk or a complication in the surgery, that puts the university or the hospital on notice, actual notice, in order to waive sovereign immunity, I think that this would be in direct contrast to what the courts were trying to prevent in Cathy versus Booth. I think the courts have recognized if this is the standard, that we are going to uphold that there's an injury and somehow the physician who performed it knew that there was an injury, therefore actual knowledge exists, then we might as well do away with the notice requirement. Because in every case where an incident occurs in the hospital, the argument could be made that we have actual notice. I ask the court not to take that position. The record in this case establishes that the University of Texas should be dismissed. There is no evidence that we knew within 6 months that we contributed or caused this incident to occur. There was a complication. We identified it. We fixed it. There is no evidence, and the appellees have presented none to you, that Dr. Uverti knew that it was his fault, and therefore his knowledge can be imputed to the university. We ask that you reverse the trial court's denial and dismiss all claims against the university at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cobb. Thank you, Mr. Maxwell. We appreciate your arguments before the court here today. They've been helpful to the court. Your case is submitted.